In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. I want to issue an apology for some content in the second interview with Harold Kotz. Harold was talking about spider entities that take control of the sacral chakra and may cause women to dream about a Jewish lover, but they actually don't want a Jewish husband. Harold continued with, "This is because the entity can control and exploit sexuality when it comes to human relations. It's rather destructive." If you're listening to this without context, it could be alarming. The second part about this entity moving from the sacral chakra to the third eye and causing religious madness, Harold mentioned this includes Muslims, the Pope, and even politicians. These statements were not broadcast with the intention to be insightful and provocative, but out of context, especially someone just tuning in like 10 minutes ago, it could be misconstrued in this way. I will be careful in preparing these types of shows in the future. The context of these shows threads back from the Shadow series that I did with Dr. Paul Dobransky, Dr. Joe Slate, Dr. Connie Zweig, Laura Shapira, and more. There's a direct connection on the topic of interference into human love relationships that can be found in past guest Evie Lorgan's books titled Love Bite and the Dark Side of Cupid. This also connects back to Jerry Marzinski's work, who pulled back the curtain about the potential source of the attacks against those with simple schizophrenia. Jerry identified the source of the problem and provides a quick and simple solution using the MACE energy method to help neutralize past traumas. Jerry explains how the weight and intensity of past traumas will attract the parasitic entities. In many cases, the person may self-medicate with alcohol or drugs, causing easier access for the etheric parasite. The indigenous wisdom traditions also point out that on the physical level, drugs and alcohol create holes in the human auric field that allow easy access for etheric parasites and psychic vampires. Not unlike how the mountain pine beetle can detect a weak tree to infest, etheric parasites can spot a weak human energy system. The revelation that spiritual warfare can be attributed to certain psychotic conditions isn't necessarily a new concept. However, the renewed understanding that the voices are very likely malevolent spiritual manifestations has begun to change the path and approach of treatment for schizophrenia. Once thought to be auditory hallucinations, many mental health therapists consider this rediscovery a breakthrough in learning the origins of the voices plaguing victims with this disorder. For many schizophrenics, the voices are known to be vulgar, grotesque, and anti-human, ultimately driving the fragmented mind further into a tormented state. The pharmaceutical companies and universities emphasize the voices aren't external and they belong to the patient. However, past guest Jerry Marzinski says, from his 30 years of experience as a mental health therapist, he's convinced the voices are external to the patient. In fact, the voices are actually some type of predator. Let's go now to hear part of that interview with Jerry Marzinski.
That's the number one thing a schizophrenic needs to do, and people that have obsessive compulsive disorders, to realize that those thoughts are not theirs, that they're being put into their thought stream by these negative entities. Okay, these things are energetic and they're parasites. And the reason they're doing that is because they want to upset the person to generate negative emotional energy, which is what they feed off of.
Now, that's an interesting area, too, because I was thinking about this element as well. It's understood that disembodied etheric parasite can interact with the human victim and cause the person to perceive thoughts that would cause negative emotional response. And that response is somehow a food source. And this is not unlike the complex nature of the liver fluke, a flatworm that takes over the brain of an ant and causing the ant to cling to the top of a blade of grass where they can be eaten by cattle or deer. The ant is placed up there during grazing hours of the cool morning or evening. It's very specific. The intelligence is incredible. Would you talk about any advancement in learning about these parasites or entities? Because the description is vague. Is it a disembodied human or is it a demon?
A lot of them are, you know, but they're demonic in nature, so they've been taking over. So there's 23 patterns I found that these things run, you know, and they're consistent, persistent patterns. Now you can, I'll see if I can find a few of them here, but you can go to my website at jerrymarzynski.com and then go to articles. And under articles, there's a list of patterns. Okay. And these patterns are the operational definition of these voices. Okay. And, you know, like the first one that I said, they're negative. They're consistently negative. They're anti-religious, you know, so why would a hallucination be anti-religious? And why would it care? They are parasites. So well, I did a study on the schizophrenics I was working with, and I've said, how much energy do you have before the voices come, and how much energy do you have after the voices come? I did a 1 to 10 scale on those things, and it turned out that it was statistically significant. They had much less energy after the voices came.
The MACE, M-A-C-E method.
That's the only psychotherapy that I've ever seen actually work. I mean, it actually gets to the core of the problem, and it will get rid of it. So you have two things going on. You have what we call a negative identity. So that's where the person has gone through a trauma and makes a decision about themselves during that trauma, and that decision is negative. And they carry that decision with them the rest of their lives. Right? That's one thing that kind of is like a computer program that runs in your mind. It's consistently negative because you don't make good decisions when you're in a traumatic state. Your decision will match the state you're in. And in a traumatic state, you're in a negative state. So something happens to the person, and the person might decide, well, I'm worthless, okay? And that decision goes with them for the rest of their life. The MACE energy method will get in there, and it will remove that negative identity. And these entities feed off of that negative identity. So it will remove the food source for these negative entities. And sometimes it will actually remove these voices, sometimes, you know. But it will remove the food source for them.
That was part of the first interview with Jerry Marzynski. He was awarded the State of Arizona's Meritorious Service Award and the Pima College Apple Award of Teaching Abnormal Psychology. He holds a BA in psychology from Temple University and a master's degree in counseling from the University of Georgia. I'll put the links to the four shows with Jerry Marzynski on inothernewsradio.com. I suspect the parasites, as you've just heard described, need their human victim to be outside of the present moment and dwelling in the anxiety of hurt or loss or whatever the voices are telling them, or worried about something that hasn't happened. Jerry's interviews will connect with Evie Lorgan's interviews and the Shadow series, and from there, the macro lens perspectives of Howdy McCoskey, Tom Montauk, and Harold Kotz. that revealed the energy harvest dynamics within human society, and also showing how human consciousness can shape reality. And that message in particular is often mentioned by the individuals who've had near-death experiences. The message is relayed usually by a guide, an angel, or a deceased relative. And it is essentially how important our thoughts, feelings, and intention are in creating our own reality. One woman who accidentally overdosed was found unconscious amid the trash in an alleyway. She also brought back a message from the afterlife, and that message was to tell people about how our thoughts and intention shape the experience we have in life. She also referenced the work of Neville Goddard, and that's how I found his work last year. Past guest Tom Montauk was on the show to discuss Neville Goddard's research in the context of human emotion interfacing with the subatomic realm, the quantum substrate, I like to call it. This is a very important key point. The organic human emotional energy is the activator in causing reality to rearrange itself and reflect back not what you want, but who you are being. Human emotion, human intention, and organic thought patterns change reality. From my understanding, artificial intelligence doesn't have the ability to shape reality, and so I suspect the controllers need to manipulate the collective human consciousness to harness the potential of a million minds. And this diversion, or this type of diversion, may prevent a true realizing of this reality-shaping ability. Past guest Matthew Deleuze is warning us that this human reality-shaping ability is being leveraged against humanity on a mass scale. He writes, quote, "Your spiritual intent in this world has been replaced by your material intent. Instead of following a prearranged spiritual plan, you will have been forced into a material maze of trickery. Instead, dark forces have mixed up the collective consciousness of mankind." We hear now from the late Max Spears, a pioneering research into the mindsets and rituals of the ancient bloodline dynasties. In his last known interview before he passed in July 2016 at the age of 39, he made a similar warning as Matthew Deleuze, a warning that at the same time reveals the immense uplifting power of the human collective consciousness. Let's have a listen.
We've handed over our power, though. We've handed over our power to these people for the longest time anyway. So I don't think it's really in our hands to be able to negotiate anything very much if we've handed over our power to them. It's about understanding why we did that in the first place, and understanding how this reality is created and built, and having an understanding of that, and understanding that the subconscious is what creates this reality.
The reason why I'm suggesting this about this handover of power, because and about the lease that you're talking about, is the there's a premise, there's a possibility at this time, whether it is a possibility or not, it's another one or not, but we could essentially take control of the situation before the next lot get back in.
Right, now I'd gone into talking about the reality and how reality is being made, and that's sort of where I'm at to talk about. So, in terms of that, so if reality is being made through the subconscious, and the subconscious has been hijacked, okay, so then this is basically for what's been done. So they have created thought prisons throughout all of our time. So thought prisons being philosophical thought prisons or religious thought prisons or any of the ones that are like that. They don't mind which one you buy into, as long as you buy into one of them and give your whole heart into it.
That was part of an interview with Max Spears speaking with host Alec on the Polish YouTube channel Parzmajmi TV, and this was titled as his last interview. it's quite a process to unlearn the untruths and become centered and living in the present moment of constant creation. That's the place, the center of the toroidal shape. Time isn't linear. Harold Kautz said it's toroidal in shape. So being in the center is a great visual for the discipline of coming back to the present moment. Holding that dominant state of, for example, ease, abundance, or anything you want in the present moment causes reality to rearrange itself and reflect back who you are being. Neville Goddard explains how human emotion is the activator causing reality to rearrange itself. Artificial intelligence can't replicate authentic human emotional fields that activate the subatomic realm. Before we hear this next audio clip, I suspect this is another great spiritual exercise to keep away the etheric parasites Jerry Marzinski describes. In fact, you may not even appear to them while you're in the present moment. Let's hear Neville Goddard in his own words from the past show with guest Tom Montauk.
Everything is rooted in the state of consciousness you occupy. So if you want to change the outer, you must first inhabit the inner state where the desire is already fulfilled. That's where power is. That's where transformation begins. To live from the end means you no longer seek permission to believe. You no longer wait for encouragement. You step into the version of yourself who already has it, and you let that version lead. You ask not, can I become this? But how would I think, speak, and act if I already were? You begin to align your choices, your posture, your energy with the person who is no longer striving, but simply being. And that shift changes everything. Because the world responds not to your words, but to your state of being. It responds to who you are, not what you want. This is why so many remain stuck. They live toward their desires, which means they're always in a state of lack. They are chasing, reaching, hoping, waiting. Their inner dialogue reinforces the distance between them and their goals. But when you live from the end, you collapse that distance. You move from someday to now. Your imagination becomes your sanctuary. In it, you rehearse the scenes of your ideal life, not as a wish, but as a memory. You walk through the corridors of your mind, already possessing what you desire. You touch it in your imagination. You smell the air. You feel the emotions. You create the vivid inner experience so deeply that it begins to feel natural. And once something feels natural, it must become real. This way of living requires intention. You must withdraw your attention from appearances and dwell in the unseen. You must refuse to be discouraged by delay. You must learn to ignore what contradicts your inner knowing. Because when you live from the end, you begin to see the world through a different lens. Everything becomes a part of the unfolding, even the detours. Even the silence, even the apparent setbacks. You are no longer shaken by what you see because you know what you have already claimed within. The world is just catching up. There is great peace in living this way. You no longer carry the weight of uncertainty. You no longer wonder if you're worthy. You have already decided. You have already assumed your place. You begin to feel gratitude, not for what is coming, but for what has already arrived in your imagination. And this gratitude, this inner thanksgiving, becomes a magnet. It pulls the invisible into the visible. It bridges the gap between spirit and matter. And slowly, without strain, life reshapes itself to mirror the state you have consistently occupied. The change will come quietly at first. A phone call, an idea, a connection, a moment of clarity, a shift in atmosphere. And then, like a flood, things begin to rearrange, not because you chased them, but because you became the version of yourself who already had them. The world bends to meet the self image you hold. It cannot do otherwise. It must obey the command given through your sustained assumption. That is the law. So begin today. Begin now. Close your eyes. Step into the feeling of already having what you desire. Let your body relax into that truth. Let your mind accept it. Let your imagination rehearse it, and let your emotions affirm it. Carry that state with you like a hidden treasure. Nurture it, protect it. Return to it often. For what you nurture within must eventually be born without. The end is not something you wait for. It is something you live from. And in doing so, you bring it into being. Gratitude in its most sacred form is not a reaction to what has already occurred. It is a declaration of trust in what is yet unseen.
And that was a part of Neville Goddard's presentation. He continues here about stepping out of the world's chaos and how irrelevant the chaos actually is to your internal alignment. And everyone knows how much the corporate media wants you to embody the chaos, suggesting your outcomes are incoherent and random. British investigative journalist and author Jenny Randles wrote in her book titled Time Storms, quote, "In essence, matter was found to comprise a flux, a myriad of energy fields whose complex interactions created what to our eyes often appear as particles. Nevertheless, this discovery proved that at a fundamental level, all reality was immaterial and not rock solid, but in truth a sea of invisible radiation energy in the form of waves," end quote. Is the fabric of our reality a pliable substrate for our conscious minds to interface with? Or, asked a different way, is the human mind designed to interface with the pliable substrate made up of waves at the subatomic level? Tom, would you please talk about what may be happening on a metaphysical level when a person correctly embodies the wish-fulfilled state, holds it, and causes reality to rearrange itself?
Well, that really is the crux of the topic that we're discussing, because this is the mechanism that makes it all work. So we have to understand possibly how it could work in order to give credence to the idea of Neville Goddard's technique. Okay. So what Jenny Randles is talking about there, she's talking essentially about quantum physics, quantum field theory, the standard model, the idea that when we look around and we see solid matter around us, that solidity is ultimately an illusion, because if you were to zoom in far enough, you would see nothing but vibrations, waves, energy, fields. Okay, there's no actual like solid particles. It's just fields and little excitations in those fields. However, all that quantum stuff, that's merely the last step in a sequence of steps that initially begins within the realm of greater consciousness outside of physicality. So I think one of the best ways to understand that reality is ultimately vibration, energy, and consciousness is to think about how things work inside your nightly dreams, okay? So when you're in your dream, you, the dreamer, all the characters in your dream, and the dream environment, those are all different facets or projections of the same exact consciousness, which is you. So all of it is happening inside of you, and yet you feel different. You feel different from all the different dream characters from your dream environment, but it's all the same thing. So when you're in a dream, okay, what happens if you were to just relax, focus, call up a particular emotion or wish, and you immerse yourself into that energetic template? Well, what happens is the dream itself begins to change to reflect that. And how does it do that? Well, it's because when you focus upon a particular idea or visual or emotion, it percolates down into your subconscious, which is generating the dream environment, and then percolates back up into the dream environment. So you're literally looking at your intentions, your emotions manifesting outwardly in the dream, but it can only work because it's all happening within your soul or your consciousness. So now consider then what happens in the waking world that we all share. Well, it turns out that yes, Buddhists and Hindus and native traditions all over the world say everything is part of a single great spirit. Everything is part of a single universal mind, you could say. But it's more complicated than that, because it's not just a universal mind. There's also a kind of universal subconscious, which the ancients, well, the ancient Greeks called the demiurge. And this demiurge is like the soul of the universe. It's like the subconscious of reality. And it is what projects and fashions the physical environment that we find ourselves within. Just as our own subconscious does within dreams, this demiurge does to all of us in waking reality. So actually, you know, there is not much of a difference then between a dream and reality, other than the fact that we have a bigger, more universal subconscious projecting the space, holding it all together, and making it way more persistent and logical and precise, you know, with physics and biology and chemistry and all those mathematical laws, than our own nightly dreams. So in that sense, our own nightly dreams are more like a low-resolution, small-scale AI model that generates an environment, whereas in waking reality, you've got the supercomputer as a metaphor, the supercomputer generating reality with a lot of persistence and so on. However, our own subconscious is actually tied into the universal subconscious the same way that a single tree in a forest is tied into the entire forest through the root system. So when you turn within and you access your subconscious, or you impress a particular vision or emotion or deep assumption or belief upon it, it kind of goes down into the very root of your being and through that root system into the greater demiurge that affects all of reality. And so in that way, by changing your own subconscious, you change your external reality. Now, the difference, of course, between, as I mentioned, between your nightly dreams and waking reality is that waking reality has this, you know, universal thing, and we are all together in this reality, sharing it together. So it's kind of like everyone being tied together by a rope. We're all in a coupled system. So therefore, things happen a little bit more slowly in reality than they do in our nightly dreams. But they still happen. So it just takes a little bit more time. It might be a little bit more indirect, but it still happens. And that's sort of the key to understanding how this can work and why Neville Goddard's techniques are effective if you apply them correctly.
I like the forest, the tree roots of the forest connection, because that references the mycelium of the fungus, right? Connecting all the roots in the forest as the medium communication. And the supercomputer of the brain, the conscious mind interfacing with reality, not in the dream state, just in the waking life. Goddard said it in a presentation how an event took place where I think it was a Navy ship or some kind of cargo ship was hijacked and taken over. Big event in the news. And he was pointing out how several weeks before, a woman wrote a piece of fiction that detailed the exact event. And he is saying, is it possible this woman created that reality in her fictional article, that, you know, one of her courses in university? And it made me think, Tom, about these weird books that we see on Amazon that were published before like a big event that have all these false flag things attached to it. It speaks to the power of the conscious mind that may have this extra part imbued with emotion that may create a reality. We may not be aware of this.
Yeah, this is actually a well-known thing within the field of writing novels. Like, so novelists, a sort of a thing that a lot of times they will encounter in the real world a character that they completely made up for a novel that they wrote years or months earlier. And the thing is, sometimes these characters are quite specific, even improbable, you know, kind of fantastical. But still, they will encounter it in the real world, which is really strange. Like, how can that happen? Well, it does make perfect sense. So if we are sharing a kind of collective dream, and if you energize a particular thought enough, it can be input into this universal subconscious and eventually, over time, pop up in your life. You know, it's crazy to consider, but that can definitely happen. Now, in other cases, of course, maybe a person was clairvoyant or precognitive and they just tapped into a future that was already on its way. You know, that's possible too. However, with precognition, you're only tuning into what could happen or what will happen, whereas with Goddard, we're talking about something where you can choose what you want to happen, and you do a certain kind of thing, the techniques that he talks about, and it manifests, okay? I mean, whether you do it intentionally or you do it unintentionally, like a novelist, when they're writing, they're really in the, I mean, they're immersing themselves in that fictional world, right? So because they imbue it with thought, with emotion, and they're almost in a kind of trance state when they're writing, well, those are the three ingredients that you need to make this work. So really, from a technical viewpoint, it's no surprise that people who write things very often, well, I don't know how often it is, but it's not uncommon, let's call it that. So it's not uncommon that they will manifest the very thing that they've been imagining very intensely.
That was part of a past show with guest Tom Montauk. And he's right, it's not uncommon. And this innate human ability is so important that replacing human parts with nanotechnology, robotics, and fulfilling the transhumanist visions will essentially remove humanity's natural power to interface with the quantum realm. Antidepressants can also temporarily sublimate the emotional capability. It will chemically alter the emotional capacity. Does that in turn affect one's ability to naturally interface on the quantum level? I'm not sure, but past guest Paul Levy, author of Dispelling Wattico, Breaking the Curse of Evil, claims, by realizing that we're all capable of terrible evil, unwittingly or not, is a beginning to dissolve its strength. Paul had a life-changing spiritual awakening and began to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. The human shadow will target those who ignore its ancient psycho-spiritual disease of the soul. Author Paul Levy calls it Wattico. It's another name for the same affliction of the shadow. Let's go now to your part of an interview with Paul Levy.
And because I think about in my life when what was happening with in my family. So here, my father, to give an example, was a very sick man and was playing out this. You know, he was acting out his unconscious and just playing out his stuff and just acting that without any consciousness. And I was in the role of the one who was not only the recipient of it, but had some form of awareness and was trying to point at it or shed light on it. And what I couldn't believe was how the entire family system, not only my mother, but the relatives, but then once mental health psychiatrists came in, they played this role too, that the whole field, the whole family system actually configured to protect the abuser. And, you know, and I didn't realize at the time because I was so young, but this is typical. Like, I became the identified patient, you know, which means I was the one in the family system who was seen to be the sick one. But it was like the whole field, like I was saying, configured to protect the abuser. And that's when I began to realize, oh, my God, there's like a higher dimensional process that's informing what's playing out. It was, in physics, they talk about the field is this non-local energy. It doesn't play by the rules of third dimensional space and time. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, of those three, the first one is seeing the field. When you begin to realize, oh, wow, actually everything that's happening there, it's all like, you know, interconnected in a certain way, that it's not separate and that it's contained within and expressions of this deeper non-local field. And so that would be the first way of seeing it. But going along with that is then you begin to realize, oh, well, once I see the field, that makes me realize that we're actually not separate from each other, that I'm not separate from you, and I'm interconnected and interdependent with you, and that you actually don't exist as an isolated, independent entity either, but you exist, you have relationship to other beings who are also, who don't have a fixed reference point, and we're all interconnected and interdependent. That's the snap out of the spell of the separate self, and that's to realize, wow, we're all actually interconnected and interdependent. And the expression of that is compassion. So that's the second of the three aspects. And the third, which goes along with number one and two, is to see the dreamlike nature of reality, that this is, you know, I just finished a book on quantum physics, and I talk about that. What quantum physics is pointing at is that there's no objective reality, but on the contrary, the act of observing the reality actually changes the reality we're observing, i.e. the observer is the observed. What I've just described, that's exactly the nature of a dream. You know, when you're in a dream, if you change your perception, the dream instantaneously shapeshifts to reflect back our change in perception, because the dream is nothing other than our own mind appearing to us. That's our nature. That's the nature of our situation right now. So it's those three things, seeing the non-local field, having the realization we're not separate, and seeing the dreamlike nature, that when you actually, you know, are accessing those viewpoints or that realization, that helps you to stabilize and be able to see Watiko. And once you see it, it can't, like a vampire, it can't stand to be seen because it takes away its power.
How long is the process of dissolving Watiko after you reach the point of understanding the dream state nature of reality?
Yeah, well, it never ends. It's an ongoing process. It's not like, oh, somebody sees it. And then if I think, oh, I've seen Watiko, now I can just rest. Well, guess what? At that moment, I've fallen under its spell. Because the point is, we all have Watiko in potential. It exists in the collective unconscious of our species. If I say, oh, that person has Watiko, you know, and I don't, well, the bug feeds off of polarization. So by me saying that, then I'm actually unwittingly, with the best of intentions, I'm reinforcing and feeding the very virus that I'm actually trying to heal. So it's important to understand, on the one hand, we all have it, which means at any moment, any of us can fall under its spell. And think about it. Who among us hasn't fallen into their unconscious and acted out their unconscious? We all have. I mean, that's what Christ was saying when he said something like, who can cast the first stone? The idea being that we've all sinned. You know, we've all fallen asleep at given moments. So it's not just like, oh, now I've seen it, and now, I mean, like I'm trying to say, if I feel like now I've seen it, and now I'm, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't fall under its spell anymore, well, guess what? You just have. So the point is to develop that mindfulness, humility, and compassion, and in a sense, that immunizes, you know, and the open heart, the empathic open heart. All of that serves as an inoculation from Watiko.
I was wondering about the use of psychological drugs such as antidepressants and other elements in our society that could suppress the awakening of seeing Watiko.
Well, the thing is this, you know, like, for example, I have a real charge around pharmaceutical drugs, because when I was having my spiritual awakening, which was a full-blown spiritual awakening, you know, I got misdiagnosed. This was in 81, you know, and I was told, oh, you have this chemical imbalance, which, you know, has then come out, you know, decades later. They've confessed, you know, psychiatric big pharma has confessed, oh, that was just completely made up and bogus. You know, the pharmaceutical companies just made that up to sell more drugs to make more money. So I'm the last person in the world to want anybody to take any sort of pharmaceutical drugs. But that being said, they can be helpful for certain people at certain moments if the suffering is just too intense, and it can help them to really get through hard times.
Right.
But they have incredibly destructive, these long-term effects. It's really about getting people hooked on them so that they become consumers of the drugs for the rest of their lives and spend a ton of money. You know, they don't even know the long-term side effects of a lot of these drugs. You know, I would just counsel people, yeah, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm just saying in this unilateral way, no, they're just bad. No, they can be really helpful, but to use them with real caution, because they can incredibly get in the way of connecting with our deeper awakening. They can create like this anesthesia in the psyche where we become numb to our feelings, and then we're not really able to deal with the deeper emotional process that's informing our being upset.
That was author Paul Levy. He had a life-changing spiritual awakening and began to recognize the dreamlike nature of reality. Paul said the act of observing the reality actually changes the reality we're observing. The observer is the observed. What I've described, he says, that's exactly the nature of a dream. Well, this gets interesting. When your boundaries are healthy and sound, and you've come to terms somewhat with your own shadow nature, it's possible to have an experience that may awaken you from the dream. Not awaken in the dream, but from it. A near-death experience and awareness of past lives helped Howdy McCoskey see beyond the false constructs of this dreamlike reality. He was on the show talking about his book titled Exit the Cave, Ending the Reincarnation Trap. And McCoskey writes, Does someone really need 997 lives out of 1,000 full of pain to learn? I don't know about you, but I learned better in school from teachers who were kind, took time with me, and encouraged me to be creative, not by someone who whacked me over the head with a stick constantly. Planet Earth is stick-whacking land. Given the way 2020 through 2022 has played out, more and more people are coming to that realization. This trap seems to be sprung just after death. In this very confused state, the soul is even more vulnerable. Few have taken the time in their waking life to learn lucid dreaming or astral travel, how to keep their awareness beyond their physical body. And so, when in the after-death realm, the average person will get sucked into the experience, similar to when having a dream, where we get swept along no matter how strange it is. The trap is already being set with the lack of awareness in our dreams. Carlos Castaneda placed much work on being aware in our dreams as a key part of the overall work. I am again starting to see why that is. End quote. Let's have a listen from that interview with Howdy McCoskey. Howdy, a friend of mine who had heart bypass surgery last year is doing great. He's 80 years old. He believes, or maybe strongly suspects, there's only an illusion of free will, not unlike the concepts in the film The Adjustment Bureau, where your life path is secretly predetermined. You mentioned this in your book, Exit the Cave, Book 1. Would you tell listeners your thoughts on this idea?
Sure. Another really good con. Do we have free will or not? And the bizarre thing is, on the examination, you can say there appears like there's a lot of free will. But as soon as somebody says, oh, that was destined to happen, or I just couldn't avoid it, you know, that was, as soon as you say it's supposed to happen, that's an indication of no free will. So where are we? And yeah, the Adjustment Bureau, which is not really the movie people think it is. People think it comes out with a happy ending with Matt Damon and Emily Blunt. They wind up together at the end and they're together. It's a happy ending. Actually, it's not. It's the opposite of a happy ending, because it just, we find out, well, they've changed to a different life script, but that life script was one of the other ones that were in the book, that the reason they let them have that life script is because they didn't matter. It's one of the life scripts. Who cares? And that's kind of where I think we're at. I think we've got maybe like 3,000 or 4,000 life scripts of possibilities, things that would make sense. Like, there's probably, given my background and the things about me, there's no life script where I'm going to be the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. That's not one of the 4,000. But there definitely would have been one where, you know, I could have been playing hockey with certain hockey teams and whatnot, as an example. So there are various possibilities that our genetics and our upbringing and our certain things will make possible. That's what we get to choose. We get to choose one of these life scripts. You could also see them as life streams. That's another word, a way of looking at it, where like literally a slightly different reality is operating really close to where you are, and you just have to make the choice, which is the best one for me. But once you're in a life script itself, in that life script, there's probably very little that gets changed because it's a life script. Now, certain things like whether I drink tea or I drink water or, you know, don't drink it at all, that maybe has so little importance in the overall story, that's on a small level like that. It's just too much information. If you think of this reality as a type of computer program, and you think of the billions and billions of creatures that are in it, that's a lot of coding. That's a tremendous amount of coding. And so if you're dealing with a life script, which is a specific code for that particular life, like in a video game character, you'd like to try to have a lot of the code not needed. You know, the stuff that's not really required, don't code that in. That, as long as it doesn't make a difference, who cares? So my sense is once you've chosen a life script, it's going to pretty much play out the way the life script says. But our choice is that we can say, that's not the life script I want. The challenge becomes, I think, if we're talking about exiting the cave, exiting the matrix, which to me, what that means is leaving the entirety of this entire matrix insane reality. That's not just the material realm, that's the etheric realm, that's the astral realm, that's the mental realm, that's the super duper happy realm, that's the fabulous realm, that's the hell realm, it's everything. You've left it all to go back to what a term that the Gnostics had called the Pleroma, the place that was prior to this creation, where this creation was. And they talk about it as an error, that this creation is an error by a type of demiurge. That's exiting the matrix is going there. And I think we all have built in automatically a life script that would do that. There is a life script that everybody has that if you followed it, if you stayed on it, if you were true to it, you could exit the matrix. And really, this system's one of the things that only it needs to do is just make sure everybody picks one of the other 3,999 options. They don't really care whether you have a good life, a bad life, you're doing okay, you're not doing okay. They're going to get some suffering energy out of us no matter what, as long as you don't pick that one. And that's kind of our job is to get to know who we are, what this reality is, and what that script is. And that life script probably is not a script where you're going to be happy. That doesn't mean try to find one of these life scripts where you're going to be unhappy. It doesn't mean that. It just means it's probably not a script that is going to be necessarily overly attractive to choose, you might say. It's got all the things we need to complete our journey. It's a very complex question, but that's how I would simplify it.
Howdy, please tell listeners about creating an album, a complete life review, a recapitulation, and releasing all debt and our unseen parts that connect to the material world as described in Carlos Castaneda's book, The Active Side of Infinity, which may be a way to retain life force in the afterlife, yet relinquish the life experiences to the archons on our way there.
So in my life, of all of the many exercises that I've done, the life recapitulation is easily one of the most important that I went through. It doesn't necessarily mean it's something that would be the most important for everybody, but those I know that have done it, and there's only a few, lots of people start it, very few people finish it. And what it is the review of every moment of your life from right now back to the moment of birth. And I know that sounds impossible. How can that be? How can I possibly review every moment of your life? Well, life isn't exactly what you think it is. Time isn't exactly what you think of it as. And the recapitulation is really about an examination of awareness and energy. And when I first ran into this idea, I did actually run into it in the Castaneda books. And I checked in with the Korean monk that I was with. And he kind of didn't tell me not to do it. He's kind of, sure, if you want to do it, go ahead. So I thought, okay, he's not telling me not to. I had no idea really what it was, what it wasn't. And I started, it took me 4.5 years to complete of pretty intense work on a bi-weekly basis. I would be, 1 week I'd be doing it, and 1 week I would take a break sort of for 4.5 years. And for most of it was really dull. Really boring. My mind hated it. My mind wanted me to stop. I did it once in a while, get some very powerful insights of things. I found looping patterns, but it wasn't. But I said, I'm going to do it. I'm halfway through this thing, so I'm going to finish. I'm going to do it. And it wasn't until I was done, until I had completed the entire review, that things started to happen. All of a sudden, a few days or weeks later, memories that I had totally forgotten about my life, like literally they were buried away. I wouldn't call them traumas. They were tiny little events that caused massive changes in which way I would go in my life. And I share one of these in Falling for Truth. Once these started coming up and I realized that, oh, the whole life I thought I'd lived was a fantasy. I thought my life was one thing, and I thought I had been a particular way. And I, of course, I was always believed I was a super great guy. And once you go through the life review and you see, well, no, I was a pretty big jerk a lot of times in my life. And a lot of things happened that I had totally forgotten about. How could I forget this? That in itself was overchanging in order to open up the totality of what life is. The second part of that was what this is doing is unwinding the tape of your life. If you consider that the tape, the tape or the CD has been recording your life from zero to however old you are, and it's just been getting heavier and heavier and heavier, more and more stuff. As you do the life review, as you go backwards in your life, you're erasing the tape. And you're seeing all the crappy, difficult things that you tried to forget. You're also seeing all the wonderful things, all the really kind things that you've done that you probably forgot about too. And you're re-getting this totality. And for me, that the life review, I've done two now. And the second one was completely different than the first one. It was a completely different process. That was a very powerful part of the work that I did of getting to know who this thing was that I see in the mirror every day. What did it do? What didn't it do? What does it like? What doesn't it like? How did it act? How didn't it act? And for anyone who's interested in Falling for Truth, I have the complete detail of how I did my recapitulation. Not that anybody should do a recapitulation the same way as anyone else. It's just like a starting point of like, okay, I'll kind of try it the way this guy did. And then after a few days, you start figuring out your process. But for me, that was really, really powerful. I talk about an album, which is another thing Castaneda talked about, which is a different, slightly different type of thing that happens after you do a life review. You pick out very specific moments that are universal, that this story that seems like it's just a useless story you would probably never, ever tell at a party. You would never, ever tell anybody ever. But that story is like, well, that's a story every single person in the world understands because it relates to them. As you go through to make an album, you seem to think, my life story is so unique. My life story is so special. Everybody else's life is so different from mine. But when you pick out these universal moments and realize, oh, actually, everybody's had this moment. Everybody's had this kind of experience. Everybody's had this kind of question. Everybody's had this kind of problem. Again, you start to gain this connecting point of like, people are all challenged. People are all in difficulty. People have all had their own traumas. And you begin to gain this space that Schopenhauer, the famous German philosopher, talked about, which is really starting to gain empathy for other people when you realize, hey, we're all suffering here. So once you realize we're all suffering, then have empathy for other creatures. And the further I've gone on in this work, the more actually I feel. Not that I think I can do anything, I can't change anything, I can't make anything better, other than present some ideas and some understanding and just really wish all the people who come across my work, for example, can get something out of it, something positive, something useful, something that they can transform that takes them one more, the next step that they need to take on the journey. And I'll say this and stop. That's all you have to find out. If you're wondering, what do I need to do? I get that question a lot from people when I'm at, you know, the small little workshops and things I do. What should I do? And really, it's not a specific answer. It's just the next thing, the next step. You don't have to worry what's five steps from now. You don't have to worry what's the really exciting step. It's what is the one you have to take right now? And that one is usually really obvious. And it's usually something that doesn't seem so grand, doesn't seem so spectacular. Those ones will come. The really exciting, interesting steps will come. They're usually two or three later, but there's something that's demanding your attention. Right? It literally might be the neighbor and you have been fighting over a fence for like 2 years, and it's like, I got to get this solved. Fence is done. Don't have to focus on this. Now what's the next step? And if you think of it in those terms, just what is the next step? The pathway gets a lot easier.
And to briefly recap, the album, The Recapitulation in Your Life, Reviewing Every Moment, is in preparation for the afterlife, when the possibility exists that you may be convinced in maybe a high-stress environment to reincarnate. This is a way to prepare and maybe not get ambushed by an event in your life that you may now be able to see more clearly. I might also add here how Neville Goddard's technique may work in this after-death preparation as you assume yourself as a sovereign spiritual being who won't be put into a reincarnation cycle or trap. That's your dominant state that you hold in the present moment at all times. It may be a sovereign spiritual being who has become adept at lucid dreaming as well. Doing this practice, in addition to creating a life album, is a start in preparing for the after-death realm. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit In Other News Radio for archives and more information about the guests.